lost a president who exemplified dignity and public service.
We remember that we are all part of a continuum, inescapably connected by the ties that bind.
A beloved First Lady whose love and support made it possible.
I always feel wonderful when I get to talk about the strongest, the most decent, the most caring man I know.
And a senator who ran for president, twice in fact.
Whatever our differences, we are fellow Americans. And please believe me when I say, no association has ever meant more to me than that.
We also said farewell to groundbreaking members of Congress, governors who made a difference in their states, and some of our favorite journalists.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle.
We celebrate their lives and their careers, coming up on the Political Junkie 2018 Remembrances Special. Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 257 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The second year of the Trump presidency ended up pretty much like the first. People mad at each other. But for this week, let's leave the sniping and the name-calling behind. Let's instead, at least for now, honor and celebrate those we lost, the giants in the political world who are no longer with us. For better or worse, these people helped make our lives more interesting and tried, in their own way, to make the world a better place. We're going to spend the next hour remembering them. We'll hear their life's highlights and lowlights, some in their own voices. We'll also hear from those who knew them. And joining me in this remembrance are Stu Rothenberg, the longtime political analyst and elections guru, and Jill Lawrence, a columnist and commentary editor at USA Today. Jill and Stu, it's great having you this week. I hope we can paint a good picture to let everyone know who these people were.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, the obvious open for the program is to talk about two people who had very full lives and who believed in public service. We'll start with this guy.
Here today are tens of thousands of our citizens who feel the understandable satisfaction of those who have taken part in democracy and seen their hopes fulfilled.
This was the inauguration of George H.W. Bush as the nation's 41st president in 1989.
But my thoughts have been turning the past few days to those who would be watching at home, to an older fellow who will throw a salute by himself when the flag goes by, and the woman who will tell her sons the words of the battle hymns. I don't mean this to be sentimental. I mean that on days like this, we remember that we are all part of a continuum, inescapably connected by the ties that bind. Our children are watching in schools throughout our great land, and to them I say, thank you for watching democracy's big day. For democracy belongs to us all, and freedom is like a beautiful kite that can go higher and higher with the breeze.
Stu Rothenberg, this was the essence of George Bush.
Yes, it was, Ken. I feel as though we've been talking about the president, the former president's decency and service over the years, but you really can't say enough. What a dignified man, what a man of deep principles, but affection for the country, affection for the people, affection for the political system, and a desire to do well. I was just found him to be a very admirable man. You know, not the greatest speaker, not the most articulate or fluid.
He did have trouble with the English language.
He was clumsy with his language, but you understood how strongly he felt about the country and about making the country better and about the dignity in treating all people.
Jill?
That's true. Well, listening to him talk, what you just played, all I could think about was the American Carnage inaugural address that the current president gave. What a contrast. I have to say that this was one of the first national campaigns I covered in 1988. And, you know, it was the year that this man, this president, ended up challenging the patriotism of Michael Dukakis because he belonged to the ACLU. I mean, there were kind of some crazy things going on that we thought were really terrible at the time, but in retrospect, they seem pretty mild, especially with the presidency that George Bush went on to have. I think he really has been proven to have worn well and to have stood for some good values that we would have been appreciative of even without Donald Trump in the White House. But I think this does kind of put everything in sharp relief. I think you're going to see every president look better as a result of this. But, I mean, you know, there was a story I read when he died about, you know, when he was a congressman from Texas, he voted for a civil rights bill that he knew his constituents wouldn't like. And he went home to Face the Music and explain it to them. And they were very hostile, but at the end they applauded him and gave him a standing ovation or, you know, really showed that they understood what he was trying to tell them. And he said that was his best night in politics. So, I mean, that's the kind of a person he was. And of course, there was also the whole thousand points of light, kinder, gentler nation. He was easy to make fun of, but these values are ones I think we wish that more presidents made more of.
One of his closest friends at the Senate, Alan Simpson of Wyoming, he's one of the guys who gave a eulogy for Bush 41 earlier this month in Washington. We're going to hear from Simpson at the end of the program, and he's going to have a lot of good insights. He's known him for a really long time. But let me just go on to back in April, 7.5 months before Bush's death, the love of his life, his wife Barbara, died, and she often talked about their love affair.
One of the reasons I made the most important decision of my life to marry George Bush is because he made me laugh. It's true, sometimes we laugh through our tears, but that shared laughter has been one of our strongest bonds. Find the joy in life, because as Ferris Bueller said on his day off, life moves pretty fast, and you don't stop and look around once in a while, you're going to miss it.
And here she was at the 1992 Republican convention.
You make me feel wonderful. But then I always feel wonderful when I get to talk about the strongest, the most decent, the most caring, the wisest, yes, and the healthiest man I know.
Jill, not everyone liked George Bush, as we pointed out before, but it seems like everyone liked Barbara.
Well, she kind of had something for everyone. She was a devoted wife and mother and also very sharp-tongued, and she had a lot of independence. I remember she kind of threw a wrench into the platform discussions at one of the conventions when an interview came out in which she said that abortion had no place in a political platform. You know, she, most like a lot of first ladies, seemed to be pro-choice on that issue when her party and her husband were not. So she had a lot of spirit. I actually didn't know her that well personally, but once, in a very strange detour from my career as a politics writer, they put me on education for 3 months, and I went to an education lunch at the White House. And I felt, because Barbara Bush was big on literacy and reading, and that was one of her big causes, and I ran into Lee Atwater there, and the two of us kind of glommed onto each other because we were completely out of our element among all of these education people. And she took one look at us, and she said to me, "I see you've found yourself some bad company." And it was very classic.
John McCain never became president, as we know, but he tried twice. The first time in 2000, he put a scare into George W. Bush's campaign before being knocked out. And then in 2008... after W's 8 years in office, McCain was the Republican nominee. It was in 2000, however, when Republican strategist Mike Murphy worked on his campaign. I talked to Mike back in August, shortly after McCain's death, and we talked a lot about the bad blood between Bush and McCain during the 2000 campaign. But Mike pointed out that McCain became a steadfast ally of the new president.
John McCain is two things. More than anything, he is a creature of public service and honor, and he believes in campaigns, as rough as they may be, as a step to the larger and more important thing of government. And he has had a knack in his life for reconciling with people who maybe treated him roughly. And the second thing is a principled conservative. He's a maverick on some issues. He's not afraid to stray from party dogma if he thinks it's better for the country. But, you know, he has been on the Republican side of the ledger, and he had a relationship that grew. I don't think they were ever best friends, but grew with respect and a good working relationship with President Bush, just like he also had with Barack Obama. you know, who beat him when he became the nominee in 2008. That was one of McCain's great gifts. He could be grumpy on occasion, though. I'm watching all this cable media about his temper.
On occasion?
Yeah, but you know, it's overdone. When I was with McCain, I didn't see a lot of temper, and I was, you know, within 20 feet of him for a year. But when McCain would push, it was particularly against bullies. You know, when he saw somebody high on the chain mistreating somebody low on the chain, that would trigger it. I never saw him get grumpy of somebody who was below him on the chain, so to speak. Like the kid would pour coffee on him before the network interview by mistake, the nervous, you know, intern, he would be sweet as hell. He saw some bullying person, then he'd get his back up a little. But I think the temper thing is a little overrated, but he could be crotchety. Scotch-Irish, he loves a good fight. And he doesn't suffer fools particularly well, particularly in the world of politics where you have to do it all day long.
I asked Mike to sum up McCain.
A cause greater than your own self-interest. He lived what he believed. He was also a happy warrior. He liked to fight, but he liked to fight for a cause. He was one in a million, and I miss him.
That was Mike Murphy, who was the senior strategist for John McCain's 2000 presidential run. Jill, how would you sum up John McCain?
That's a very tough question. We had a long and very fraught relationship. It had its ups and downs, and he didn't talk to me for the last 6 years of his life because of a piece I wrote. It was very complicated. But in 1999, I had a choice of covering his campaign or Bill Bradley's, and I chose his, of course, because it was A, a lot of fun, and B, seemed to be going somewhere. And that was the experience of a lifetime. And he, you know, a lot of what happened that year kind of set his image in stone for America, I think. And it was a very tough primary campaign against Bush. I'll never forget arriving in South Carolina after he had a 19-point victory over Bush in New Hampshire, and Bush suddenly debuted a new slogan called Reformer with Results, stealing the reformer tag and implying, of course, you know, that he was a governor and he'd actually had results as opposed to McCain being in the Senate. So it was, you know, very brutal, and they had very different ideas about what to do about taxes. And for instance, McCain was very populist. He had been trying to cap CEO pay in the Senate. You know, he was a different kind of Republican than Bush. And but they managed to reconcile.
I was going to say he was also chastened by his involvement in the Keating Five.
Right. So that's when he was working on campaign finance and trying to clean up the system, you know, kind of as penance. But he also really believed it.
Stu, other than his antipathy for Joe Lawrence, how would you sum up McCain?
Well, I think Jill's right in that he was a bit of a contradiction. I mean, at various times of his life, he was viewed certain ways and behaved certain ways. I can remember having a conversation at a resort with then U.S. senator, who I won't identify, who spent at least half an hour talking to me about how John McCain was emotionally unstable and untrustworthy and could never be president and had the worst temper in the world and went on and on. I'll let you guess who the senator was. And at the same time, it's the same John McCain who represents, I mean, he was a hero. He was kind of one of the last icons, in my view, of the Senate, kind of the old Senate old bulls, someone who could be incredibly nice. I mean, he was nice to me on a couple of occasions where he didn't need to be all that nice to me. And so I just found him to be a truly interesting figure. You know, we, Ken, and I think you'll probably agree, we cover a lot of people. We see a lot of campaigns. We see these politicians every day. John McCain was among the most interesting of any of them. You knew at any minute he could say anything, and he would be in the middle of the action if he wanted, and he often wanted.
You called him a hero. That reminds me of the famous quote by Donald Trump in 2015.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if, whatever you think of McCain's legacy, how it was possibly made even stronger in his final months in office.
I think the two things that toward the end of his career that we'll all remember, we'll identify it with John McCain, is one, the comment to the woman at the McCain rally about Obama being a Muslim, and he he stepped right in and said, no, right. Ma'am, you're wrong. And that was stunning. And then when he walked into the chamber and gave the thumbs down on the health care, a dramatic moment when you looked around at the other Republicans in the chamber.
Mitch McConnell and the glee,
and John Cornyn, as I recall, and the glee that McCain had in doing that. I mean, that was perfect John McCain.
That's right. You're right about those two things. One thing I wonder, was he doing that? He said he was doing it because the Senate process had gotten totally messed up. But, I mean, he had this kind of mischievous air about him, like he knew exactly what he was doing, not just about procedure, but also about policy. So, I mean, I don't know how he really felt about all that in the end.
Well, Stu just mentioned two of McCain's greatest moments. Let me add a third. It's his concession speech to Barack Obama in 2008.
Senator Obama has achieved a great thing for himself and for his country. I applaud him for it and offer him my sincere sympathy that his beloved grandmother did not live to see this day. Though our faith assures us she is at rest in the presence of her Creator, and so very proud of the good man she helped raise. Senator Obama and I have had and argued our differences, and he has prevailed. No doubt many of those differences remain. These are difficult times for our country, and I pledge to him tonight to do all in my power to help him lead us through the many challenges we face. I urge all Americans. I urge all Americans who supported me to join me in not just congratulating him, but offering our next president our goodwill and earnest effort to find ways to come together, to find the necessary compromises to bridge our differences and help restore our prosperity, defend our security in a dangerous world, and leave our children and grandchildren a stronger, better country than we inherited. Whatever our differences, we are fellow Americans. And please believe me when I say, no association has ever meant more to me than that.
Just talking about John McCain, who died on August 25th, other former members of the Senate left us as well in 2018. Daniel Akaka was the first U.S. Senator of Native Hawaiian ancestry. When John Tunney was elected from California in 1970, defeating Republican incumbent George Murphy, many talked about him about being a future presidential candidate, but he was defeated after one term by Sam Hayakawa. John Melcher served two terms in Montana, that was a beaut, before losing in 1994 to Republican Conrad Burns. Another two-term Democratic senator who left us this year was Walter D. Huddleston of Kentucky. He was defeated in 1984 in an upset by Mitch McConnell. Joe Tidings didn't even make it to his second term, and if the Maryland Democrat's name doesn't ring a bell, it should. In 1964, he defeated Republican incumbent J. Glenn Bell. And 6 years later, he was voted out of office by Bell's son, J. Glenn Bell, Jr. Zill Miller was an interesting character. A conservative Democrat, Governor Miller gave a keynote address at the 1992 Democratic Convention that nominated Bill Clinton. And 12 years later, as Senator Miller, he gave the keynote address at the 2004 Republican Convention, where he endorsed President George W. Bush for re-election. Stu, that's, I mean... a keynote address at a Democrat and then a Republican convention.
Right. That sums up the era from A to Z. At the beginning, you had there were lots of Southern Democrats, conservative Democrats, and by the end of when did Zell Miller switch parties?
Well, he never switched parties. He remained a Democrat, but he endorsed Bush over Kerry
in 2004.
Yeah.
So by the early 2000s, those conservative Democrats were disappearing, and they were voting Republican, and subsequently would end up registering Republican, and many would run as Republicans. So Zell Miller shows kind of a larger change in American politics, I think.
Yeah, he was a complicated guy. I mean, he was kind of reflective of that kind of politician that's unpredictable. I was covering on the road for the John Kerry campaign in 2004 and at that Republican convention, and I must say that his speech precipitated my very first fact check. I got so agitated listening to him talk about John Kerry that I actually wrote my first one. But he was also the Georgia governor who put in place, I believe it was him who did the big scholarship program that endures to this day. It's very valuable for kids who want to go to college there. He just had a lot of different dimensions to him.
Well, you talked about that famous speech at the Republican convention. Let's play some of that.
This is the man who wants to be the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces. U.S. Forces armed with what? Spitballs? This politician wants to be leader of the free world. Free for how long? For more than 20 years, on every one of the great issues of freedom and security, John Kerry has been more wrong, more weak, and more wobbly than any other national figure.
It's one thing to have a Senate across parties to back a presidential candidate. Joe Lieberman did that with John McCain in 2008. But to hear Miller give this such an angry speech. I mean, he says, it's more about country over party. This was especially
angry. Yeah, the more I listen to these speeches, the more I wonder why I ever got involved in politics.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just making up stuff along the way, and it's reached, obviously, a totally different level now with our politics. But yes, this was fiery. Of course, some of this is those Southern Democrats knew how to give speeches. You know, they could wind up and really deliver it. But looking back, it seems like, yeah, John Kerry was a liberal Democrat and George Bush was a conservative Republican. But to kind of accuse John Kerry of, if he was elected, the country wouldn't be free. It seems crazy, doesn't it?
Well, it does to me. And I mentioned that to Paul Begala, the Democratic strategist, who would work to elect Zell Miller governor.
Carville worked on that.
Yeah, Carville and Begala. Yeah. But I asked Begala about that speech at the convention, and he completely brushed it off.
You can't reduce a 60-year career to one speech, particularly that one. This is a man who created pre-kindergarten statewide in Georgia, a policy that 20 years later, Barack Obama proposed, a progressive Democratic president, and could not get Congress to pass. This is a guy who created the Hope Scholarships, which has educated 1.8 million Georgians. 90% of the students at the University of Georgia are going on a Hope Scholarship because of Zell Miller. This is something Bernie Sanders could only dream of doing. So he has been, of course we lost him now, he has been a remarkable progressive public servant. Now, it is true in the Senate, he hated the Senate. He hated Washington. He never should have taken that job, and he would have told you that. And he never would have, except for Senator Coverdell's passing, and he felt a duty to serve. But he hated Washington, and he liked George W. Bush. I saw President Bush at the funeral. It was wonderfully gracious of President Bush to attend. And he went there, and of course he said those things, and he meant them. That's why he said them. But it's really not fair to take a 60-year career and say, well, he gave this red-hot, red-meat speech for the Republican president who he did support. But the long arc of that man's career was a solidly progressive career.
Jill, that basically what Paul's saying is what you said earlier.
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't have to give a speech like that as your keynote. Barack Obama certainly didn't, and he made a good impression. I mean, he just went on the attack after a guy who had actually served in Vietnam. I mean, it was just a very – it struck me as really – different and much more emphatic than, much more of an attack. I don't know. I mean, well, I told you. I said, okay, this is it. I'm writing a fact check. That's not something that happens with every speech. At least it didn't used to.
Can you remember where he was from? What town Zelmiller was from?
No, I do not.
Young Harris, Georgia.
Young Harris.
I always thought that was a great tidbit. Young Harris, Georgia. Look that up, Jill. You better do a fact check. Better do a fact check.
Young Harris.
I'm here with young Stu and young Jill here. We heard earlier from Democratic strategist Paul Begala, who had a 30-year friendship with Zelmiller. Miller died March 23rd at age 86. Like Miller, Paul Laxalt didn't leave a big mark in the Senate. He served two terms from 1975 until his retirement after 1986, and he was governor of Nevada before that. But he was known as Ronald Reagan's best friend in the Senate. And that has to be a good thing when you could just pick up the phone and get the president on the line whenever you want.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was his reputation. He was close to Reagan, but he was close to a lot of political figures. You know, Paul Laxalt was not like a Mr. Dynamo. He was kind of a low-key guy. I knew him reasonably well in that I kept getting invited to Christmas parties at his home, Paul and Carol Laxalt. And it was always a fascinating mix. Evan and Susan Bayh, Democratic governor and the senator from Indiana, were always there. George and Susan Allen, Republican governor and that's from Virginia, was always there. Justice Scalia was always there. Carol Laxalt made the best chili in the universe. Chuck Robb and his wife and there were lobbyists. Frank Pankoff was always there. Yeah. It was this classic Washington insider mixture across party line, across people of different ages and experience. And it was a fascinating group. And Paul Laxalt was a very decent, kind man. But you're right. His claim to fame was A. Ronald Reagan and being sociable enough to talk to people across the aisle.
And after Reagan was leaving office in 1988, Laxalt thought about running for president. He couldn't raise the money. But two, with the loyal Vice President George Bush in the race and Jack Kemp, the conservative heir apparent, there was really no room for Paul Laxalt, so he just never went through it.
What Stu is describing is really sounding like a whole other era in American political history.
Yes.
Well, there were quite a few governors who left us this year as well. Republicans George Duke Majin of California and Bob Ray of Iowa. I mean, the longest name and the shortest name in the history of governors, I believe, Duke Majin and Ray. And Democrats Phil Hoff of Vermont and Brendan Byrne of New Jersey. I always thought Brendan Byrne was Italian. Did I ever tell you this? Every time I would drive on the New Jersey Turnpike, I would see a sign that says Brendan Byrne Arena. I thought he was Italian. I didn't know that. Okay, that didn't work. But
well,
let me just say one thing about Phil Hoff, though. Phil Hoff he was elected governor of Vermont in 1962. I think the first Democrat elected governor since 1066. But he really brought in the era of Democratic politics. I mean, Patrick Leahy, when he was elected to the Senate in 74, he was the first Democrat elected Senate since the Civil War, I think. But now you think of it as a solidly Democratic state, if not a socialist state with Bernie.
Well, it's funny. And then you look at a couple of these governors, other governors that you've mentioned, Duke Majin and Ray, and you again get a sense on how the parties have changed, how the country has changed. I mean, Duke Majin, a rather bland governor, Republican governor of California, was not a bomb thrower in the Pete Wilson sense at all.
Not at all.
You know, not the new Republican Party. He's the
and
old
he was a conservative.
California. He was, but not in the flashy, bombastic, Trumpian kind of way. And Bob Ray in Iowa was a liberal Republican.
Yeah. Well, he would never survive in this
absolutely
climate,
not.
I mean, the Duke Majin is the kind of person we don't really see much anymore because he was crossing the aisle. And one of the things that's been highlighted about him is how he, I guess he was Armenian, and he had a lot of empathy for the black victims of apartheid in South Africa, and he was very much for the University of California divesting, and they did it. They divested to the tune of $3 billion, and Mandela later said that was one of the first blows at apartheid that really had an impact. So, I mean, you know, these are people who did what they thought was right, and they seem much more three-dimensional in some ways than what's going on now.
Well, you mentioned apartheid, and that leads to, you know, I know there are a bunch of former House members who died this year, but But the list has to include Ron Dellums of California. And I mean, Ron Dellums, we talked about how fascinating Bush and McCain and all these people were. Dellums fascinates me. I mean, he was this one-time anti-Vietnam War. He was a black radical. I mean, that's what they saw him as, with the Afro back.
Anti-apartheid.
Especially anti-apartheid, who not long after arriving in Washington, he found himself on Richard Nixon's enemies list. He opposed nearly every foreign and domestic policy of the Nixon and Ford administrations, nearly every military program. And then he wound up becoming the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. I mean, that's how do you make up a story like that? Well, anyway, but as I was mentioning, you know, he was an emotional leader in the fight for sanctions on the apartheid regime in South Africa. Here he is during a 1985 debate on sanctions.
When I look at black people dying and suffering in South Africa, I ask why. We've dropped bombs on no one. We've harmed no one in the world. Yet for some incredible reason, black people have suffered at an extraordinary level all over the world. And at this point, it is heightened in its intensity in South Africa. I offered a proposal today in no paternalistic fashion whatsoever, because I'm not doing it out of a missionary spirit, because I believe taking a stand against apartheid with as much power and courage and conviction as one can is as important to the healing and the well-being of this country as it is to the healing and the well-being of people in South Africa. And so it is for both of those reasons that I think it's important for all of us here to unite in a magnificent statement. I applaud the efforts of my distinguished colleagues, but I understand that I am outside that consensus and have been for the 14 and a half years that I've been here. And my role has been, as a progressive person, to stand out there to try to be on the cutting edge. But it becomes very frustrating and incredibly painful if that's the only role that one plays.
This fascinates me, too. When Dellums resigned his seat in 1998, he was the subject of many tributes on the House floor, including this one.
There's very few members that have served in this body that can claim the respect that both sides of the aisle have for the gentleman from California, and the incredible reputation that the gentleman, Mr. Dellums, has brought to this House. He has elevated this House. He's elevated the distinction of this House by serving here, and this House will greatly miss him when he leaves.
Stu, who is that?
That was the Hammer, Tom DeLay, last person who I would have thought would have offered a tribute to Ron Dellums, at least the last person in terms of their ideological incompatibility. Remarkable.
Wow, that is incredible. One thing that struck me about your list, Ken, is how many pioneers and pathbreakers and trailblazers there are on it. You know, women and minorities who just came to Congress at a time when this was a new thing and they really had to pave the way. And he was one of these people who I think was probably, you know, an incredibly educational experience for the rest of the members of Congress.
Well, I think another is talking about influential women who served in Congress, Louise Slaughter. I think she's born in Kentucky, but she represented Rochester, New York, and, you know, that accent.
She had that southern drawl, and it didn't fit, but
And yet she knew power and knew how to wield power, and she was 88 years old. She had already announced that she was running for re-election, and she died very unexpectedly. And Congressman Paul Tonko of Albany, New York, was on the show shortly after her passing, and he talked about his long friendship with Slaughter.
It's no stretch of the rhetoric to state that she was a treasure to the House, just the way she was able to carry forth with very strong policy that would address the great many of us as Americans. She was about doing what was right, whether it was popular or not. And what I think I most respected about Louise Slaughter was that she did not serve as a weather vane politician. She knew the dynamics because she studied all of the issues with intensity and depth. And if something had to be done, if there was a wrong that needed to be righted, if there was an injustice that needed to be wiped away, she went forth as a warrior.
That was Congressman Paul Tonko remembering his New York Democratic colleague, Congresswoman Louise Slaughter, who died March 16th. Among other former members of Congress who passed this year were John Buchanan, who was elected in the Goldwater sweep in Alabama in 1964 as a strong conservative, and Margaret Heckler, who was, I guess, a liberal Republican out of Massachusetts.
Well, actually, Ken, Buchanan may have been elected as a conservative in that Goldwater year, but he turned out to be a liberal Republican.
He did, didn't he?
And in fact, I came to Washington in June of 1980, and I believe that's the election where the conservatives, conservative groups, conservative activists from Richard Viguerie to Paul Weyrich and Howard Phillips and the people on the new right.
Nick Pack.
They found this candidate, Albert Lee Smith, knocked him off in 1980. And Albert Lee Smith was the kind of prototype new right conservative taking on John Buchanan, who he treated with great contempt as this liberal Republican. And actually, he was a more liberal Republican.
He was a good guy.
As for Margaret Heckler, she is another indication of changing times, if I'm correct, and you'll know this better than I will. She was thrown in redistricting in a district with Barney Frank. And Margaret Heckler and Barney Frank fought it out. And I remember initially people thought that Margaret Heckler was better positioned, but Frank ended up winning that seat and ending Margaret Heckler's congressional career. Though, was it after that she moved? She was Secretary of Health, Education,
under
Welfare,
Reagan, that's correct.
Yeah.
And she was a character, by the way. I met her at some events, and she was, I think she believed in spirits and things like that. She was a wild person. But here's a great trivia question. When she came to Congress, she beat, and in the Republican primary, she beat a guy by the name of Joseph Martin, who had been the Speaker of the House.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what ended Joe Martin's career.
Yeah. But again, then Margaret Heckler was one of the last Republicans from New England, and now you really have to look under rocks and behind under beds to find Republican members of Congress.
There was no longer a New England Republican in Congress, in the House. You have Susan Collins, but we'll see what Susan Rice does to her next year. One person I don't want to forget is somebody who represented not the left wing nor the right wing, but the right course of action. Linda Brown was only 12 years old, living in Topeka, Kansas, when she became the unlikely center of the landmark Supreme Court case Brown versus Board of Education. That changed history.
Yeah, it did. Remember, separate used to be okay to be
separate but equal. Yeah.
And then the court ruled that separate was inherently unequal. And it changed the way we looked, at least formally, officially, in terms of education and schooling and opportunities. Now, some people will tell you that if you look around this country even now, the amount that's spent on students in certain states and certain areas is still unequal. But she helped establish a principle of equality that has kind of defined the more modern era, I think.
Well, racial segregation is no longer allowed.
Yeah. Well, it's informal because of the way neighborhood schools work, and the sort of history of housing discrimination. But it's good to have it in law that, you know, the precedent that it's not the right thing to do. And she was 12, I think, when this was going on, and she was one of these accidents of history, but she really appreciated integration. She said her kids went to integrated schools and that they seemed to, you know, that it was much better for kids to get to know each other in these settings and much better for the country. So I think, and she also was a consultant and a speaker, and I think she really did understand ultimately what her role in history was.
And speaking of accidents in history, does either of you recognize the name Juan Romero?
He was a catcher for the Cleveland Indians, wasn't he?
No.
I'm kidding, Ken.
Sorry.
He was that busboy at the Ambassador Hotel in June of 1968. He was the guy who cradled
Bobby Kennedy
after he was shot. And that image will always be ingrained in my memory.
That's right. I saw that he
Juan
passed
Romero
away.
Juan Romero died this year, too. Someday, soon, he's going to be one day.
Abraham and Martin and John.
I don't know how we could end our conversation without talking about the journalists who cover these politicians, the journalists who are under attack, you know, throughout the world, but especially at home. I think the most alarming thing about the new political reality is the way journalists are treated, especially at home. There was Betty Ann Bowser, who became a CBS News correspondent in the 1970s, when very few women had that position. Adam Clymer covered 8 presidents for the New York Times and other newspapers. Stu, you remember what Adam Clymer is probably best known and remembered for?
I do. That was the open mic incident where President George Bush...
Candidate Bush.
George Bush pointed out Clymer was in the crowd, and Bush leaned over to Cheney and said, "Look, there's Adam Clymer. He's a major league a-." And as I recall, Cheney said, "Big time."
Yep,
did
big
he not?
Time. Yep.
Yes, this is what used to count as an attack on a journalist.
That's a good point, right?
I knew Adam a little bit. He was from Manhattan. He grew up in New York. He went to Harvard, worked for a number of newspapers, including, I believe, the Baltimore Sun, was a terrific political reporter, Congress, the president, like that. But he also had an expertise in and later moved over into polling and was partially responsible, at least, for the New York Times polling unit.
Well, Lawrence Grossman was the head of PBS and later NBC News. Nicholas von Hoffman was a controversial and fearless reporter and columnist for The Washington Post. Steve Comaro covered politics for the AP and later CQ Roll Call. Jill, you knew Steve.
I met Steve the first minute I walked into the AP office in 1982, and I worked with him there, and I also worked with him at USA Today. He covered the Pentagon, and he covered wars. He was just a real reporter's reporter, and he was always doing things like rescuing dogs from Afghanistan. And it's tragic that he left us so soon. His job when he died was being the head of CQ Roll Call, and he was training a whole new generation of young reporters to cover Capitol Hill, where he had been a budget reporter and a military reporter and just had covered all kinds of things. So we definitely lost him too soon.
Well, another beloved journalist, not a young reporter, but was Carl Castle of NPR. He was a veteran newscaster. And then he found his calling as a comedic straight man on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So Carl was a character and always a delight to talk about. Bob Fuss was a longtime friend who covered Capitol Hill for elections, political conventions for UPI, NBC Radio, Mutual, and CBS News for decades. Did you guys know Bob?
I did not.
I knew him a little bit. I once did an Arizona debate for CBS, and I was out there with him, and boy, it was a struggle for him to get around, but he was a really classy reporter and easy to deal with.
Well, he always told the best stories, and he was on this program a few years back plugging his book, Kidnapped by Nuns, and other stories about life on the radio. He always had the greatest stories, but he had one great story about one of his bosses, Lou Geiserman.
Lou Geiserman is an extremely talented and wonderful news executive who I worked with and worked for a while at UPI Radio years ago. And he then went on to work at WCBS in New York and Bloomberg and lots of different places. A great guy. But like many managers in radio, he loves man-on-the-street interviews. And reporters hate man-on-the-street interviews. I've never met a reporter yet who doesn't hate.
They're useless.
They're terrible. You walk up to strangers and you say, you know, what do you think about gay marriage? And if they don't hit you, then sometimes
or kiss you.
Right. You know, it's just silly. And it, as far as I'm concerned, it adds nothing to a story. But managers love it. And he loved it more than most. And so when he was leaving to go to another job, we were asked, all of us at different bureaus around the country and around the world who worked for UPI at that time, to do little, you know, recorded vignettes for his going away party, which was going to be in New York. So I decided the best way to do that would be man-on-the-street interviews. And so I just went outside and started asking random people what they thought about Lou Geiserman and got lots of great answers. I heard from Lou, by the way, and he said he liked the book except for that part.
Bob was such a good guy. He died young. He was just 64 years old. He had leukemia. He died on May 27th. I miss him. And Charles Krauthammer died, and he was one of the leading conservative voices for The Washington Post and Fox News.
I really loved his columns. I thought he was a great writer. I thought he was insightful, and he pointed out contradictions, and he used history. And I just thought he was a real classy guy. And
he was no fan of Donald Trump.
That's right. Yeah, he was a conservative, but he was not a Trump conservative. He was the kind of more of a traditional conservative, the kind of George Will, the Charles Krauthammer school of conservatism.
Well, my friend Mara Liasson of NPR sat next to him for years as a panelist on Fox's Sunday show with Bret Baier. And I said to her, you know, it was unusual that conservatives and liberals both mourned his passing. Here's what she said.
Charles was an example of, unfortunately, a dying breed, a disappearing breed, which is he was a conservative intellectual. He was not a partisan hack. He wasn't, there was nothing tribal about Charles Krauthammer. He came to his opinions through reason and study, and he wasn't just a member of a team. That's the big problem with politics today, is so tribal. It doesn't matter what the guy on your side says. You're just going to be with him no matter what. And Charles was a conservative, and he wasn't really a never-Trumper. In other words, he wasn't out there trying to stop Trump necessarily. And when Trump did something that he thought was conservative, and of course Trump has done many, many things that conservatives like, he praised him for it. But when he didn't, when he broke the norms of little d democracy in terms of the things he said or the way he went about undermining democratic institutions, Charles called him out for that too. And that's why I think he was so beloved across the political spectrum.
That was NPR's Mara Liasson talking about the conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer, who died June 21st at the age of 68.
I mean, one of the things that we haven't said, his words carried so much weight, whether you agreed with him or not, because of the place he came from personally, which was he had a medical degree in education. He had overcome tremendous personal adversity. You know, he carried a gravity. You couldn't dismiss him. Everything he said came from his experience and his beliefs, obviously. And some of the most affecting things about him came out after he died when we found out, you know, the help he had given to other people who were facing health crises and big obstacles in their lives. So he was very generous that way.
Jill and Stu, you know, I get very melancholy when each year when we do this. I have a deep affection for those who gave it themselves to make this a better country. Stu has given me a look, but it's really from the heart because I love these people cared about their country. They cared about public service, and I think I appreciate that we spend this time each year to honor the folks who left us and who made a difference.
I guess my attitude is evolving, given the first 2 years of the Trump presidency and how some people who I think have meant well haven't spoken up when they should have. I think it's great that people commit to public service and spend time trying to help people rather than simply making money for themselves, and that's all good. But I think it's also important to speak out when you see abuses and injustices.
Profiles and courage, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's part of it. And that's what, you know, that's what made John McCain so appealing to many people, I think, that he would call people out. And maybe he didn't do it all the time. Maybe he didn't do it enough. Maybe he did it too much. I mean, everybody can decide for themselves. But we're at a point, I think, in American politics, American history, where everybody has a role in speaking out here, and just for the sake of honesty.
It's interesting to think about what we'll be saying about some of these people in years to come, the people who didn't speak up. I don't think it's been a great period of American history these last 2 years, not on Capitol Hill.
I was thinking of that when Lamar Alexander announced this week his retirement, and a great guy, believes in bipartisanship, but he could have stood up and said things that he just didn't do.
I thought of Lamar Alexander 15 seconds ago as we were talking about this as the poster child for this, a man of seriousness and education and a governor and secretary of education, a person of accomplishment, a moderate Republican, a pragmatic Republican, but a conservative. And yet Bob Corker, the retiring Tennessee, the other Tennessee senator, has been much more outspoken. And I was disappointed. I thought Lamar Alexander was the kind of person who had the substance, the weightiness, and the intellectual heft to speak out. And I've been disappointed that he hasn't.
Well, he has two more years.
Well, maybe. Go ahead, Jill.
Well, I was going to say maybe I'm being too kind to him, but what I remembered was that he continued to negotiate and continued to put forth bipartisan bills throughout this whole thing with Patty Murray mostly. You know, he had a good partnership, and I'm hoping that in the next 2 years, I'm thinking maybe that's why he announced so early that he's retiring. That's why he once left the Republican leadership long ago, saying he wanted more flexibility to be more bipartisan and make more deals. And so maybe that's what he's thinking now. I hope so, but I agree with you, Stu. I hope he speaks up more.
Jill Lawrence is a commentary editor at USA Today, and Stu Rothenberg is a longtime campaign analyst. I enjoyed being with you guys again this year, exploring these memories, and thank you both so much.
Thanks, Kenny.
Thank you.
We opened the program by talking about the passing of George H.W. Bush, what kind of person he was, what he represented in politics as a profession. Few people knew him longer or better than Alan Simpson, and that's how I want to end this program. Their relationship goes back to the days when the only Bush in politics was Prescott Bush, George's father, who was a senator from Connecticut, and the only Simpson was Millward Simpson, Al's father, who was first elected to the Senate in 1962. That's how the two first became friends, and I'll let Alan Simpson tell the rest of the story. I should say that Alan gave a very moving eulogy at President Bush's funeral in Washington earlier this month, and I am honored to have him on the program now to talk about his friendship with the 41st President of the United States. Alan Simpson, you are the man.
Well, Ken, you're biased. We met back at the Republican Convention in 1980, and that's when Ronald Reagan was elected, and then I went on to a stellar career in the Senate. I could have been king, but they wouldn't have it. But now, back to George Bush. It was such a pleasure and a joy to have his friendship, and it was something that you didn't want to talk about in your time because it sounded like bragging, but we had just a hell of a lot of fun together.
Well, actually, when I met you, the week I met you, that was the week that Ronald Reagan surprised everybody by coming to the convention a day early and announcing his choice for vice president was George Bush.
Yes, that was quite a thing there. It was whether it be George Bush or even Jerry Ford. There was lots of stuff going on at that point. Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld were in the middle of that mix. That was a very fascinating time. Of course, that was when you honed your political skills, everything but scuttlebutt, which made you sink to a new level.
Well, I think more Americans need to play scuttlebutt, and I don't think people understand the significance of it, but that's for another conversation completely. I just want to tell you that how touched I was by watching you at the National Cathedral when you gave your eulogy. It was, first of all, the whole thing was such a moving ceremony. I thought John Meacham was fantastic. And yet when I watched you get up to speak, and I was watching on TV, but I started to smile. Now, this is, you know, with all the solemnity and the sadness about his passing, and yet I knew that you would not talk about sadness, but you would talk about joy, and you would talk, you know, not about losing George Bush, but about us having been fortunate to have had all that time with him. I knew you would do that.
Well, it was a very great honor and a great privilege, without question. But someone said, we thought you did pretty well. I said, well, if you have 5 years to prepare something for 10 minutes, you should do well. Because you remember when he said, put the harps back in the closet?
Right.
That was 5 years back. And that's when the family called and said, we would like you to speak. Now, George never asked any of us, Brian or Meacham or myself, to speak. He didn't like talking about that stuff, but the family did. So I made some notes when they told me that, and I was very honored. And then 3 years later, they said, now it's coming. And so I made more notes. And then I went to see him in July in Kennebunkport. He said, come on up and see me.
Please tell me that story. I never heard this before, the story of how you met George H.W. Bush, that story about the transfer of Senate offices in 1962.
Well, my dad was elected to the U.S. Senate, and Ann and I were helping him. I was his campaign manager, and we went back to see him get settled in. He won the race in 62, and he went back, and he was assigned a Senate office, former Senator Prescott Bush of Connecticut. And George Bush was there with his father, saying, Pop, let me help you. And I was there helping my pop in, and Dad took several of Prescott Bush's staff into his new staff as a U.S. Senator. And that's when I first met George Bush. And then when Dad and Mom left the Senate in 66, Dad had arthritis and Parkinson's. He was not well. He lived another 20 years. But when they left Washington, they sold their house to a brand spanking new congressman from Texas named George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara, and they did that on a handshake. But there were intimate times, a friendship, a lovely, warm, lovely friendship of laughter, joy, singing, throwing snowballs off the roof of the White House, walking the dogs. One night there was fresh snow, all just gorgeous. And George said, "Yeah, doesn't that remind you of throwing snowballs?" I said, "Sure does." And he said, "Well, let's go up on the roof and throw snowballs." I said, "Sounds good to me." And we did let the Secret Service know that we were up there throwing snowballs because they were rather concerned otherwise. And so there were times, as I say, theater, movies, times at the Kennedy Center, in the President's Box. We felt very privileged, and yet we were very guarded to let people know that, these were our friends, so that we would never violate the friendship or use it for self-aggrandizement or puff ourselves up. But it was the kind of thing, when I prepared those notes, I cried and cried hard so I wouldn't cry when it came time to give them.
Well, a lot of us cried at it, but, what I was thinking, I mean, we all know how self-deprecating you can be, and this story really touched me. This was 1991. This is from your eulogy. It was 1991. The Gulf War had gone well, and Alan Simpson was having a bit of a tough time with the press. Here's what you said at the eulogy.
Now, my life in Washington was rather tumultuous. I went from the A socialist to the Z and never came back to the A. In one dark period, I was feeling awful low, and all my wounds were self-inflicted, all of them. And George called me early one morning, always early in the morning, country music playing in the background, and he said, "Ah, I see the media is shooting you pretty full of holes." Actually, he said it a bit more pungently than that. And he said, "Why don't we go up to Camp David? You and Ann come over and we'll have a weekend together." At that time, his popularity rating was 93%. Mine was 0.93%.
I love that so much. And actually, when you were speaking, and of course I'm watching this on TV, and I don't know if you saw the replay of the funeral, but through it you could hear George W. Bush cackling in the background. I mean, he was just giggling the whole way through. You could see George and Laura and Jeb and their families. They all talked and they all had tears and they all laughed. And I noticed when you came up to give the speech, you said something to George W. Bush, and you heard him giggling at that too. So this is a funeral, and this is remembering the loss of a great man, the departure of a great man. And yet, as you've always said, there's the importance of laughter, of having a sense of humor, and you certainly didn't let anyone down that day.
That's true, and you know it. And when you have a great sense of humor and a sense of whimsy, which is even more dangerous, because when you have whimsy and love of the absurd and humor, People think you're about half goofy, and they'll say, you know, he's not serious. Let me tell you, my humor has enabled me to have my sword and my shield. And I've been in lawsuits, and I've been in situations where they say, I think Simpson is nuts. You remember the movie Lincoln, when the guy was standing outside of Lincoln's office said, do I have to go in there again and hear that nut give one of his parables or one of his stories? The other guy said, yeah, you will. And that was Lincoln's, that was the sharpness. That was the pinnacle of his ability to penetrate the, you know, insincerity and all the babble of Washington while he was.
Please don't tell me how that movie ends, okay?
Yes.
You know, I was just, let me ask you this one question. I was just thinking of how high in the polls President Bush was in those early goings of 1991. And yet a year later, he was voted out of office. He was a one-term president. For such a proud man, that had to be difficult for him.
Yeah, well, he was misinterpreted. A lovely shot at him in the groin was, I think, Newsweek magazine had the cover and called the wimp factor. Here's a guy that probably was called the wimp factor by some guy running Newsweek who'd hidden out in Canada during the Vietnam War. And he could not believe that Bill Clinton could be elected. That's what threw him off, because he didn't hate Bill Clinton. In fact, they became dear, dear friends. But he couldn't believe that a draft dodger and a guy with moral problems like that would be president.
You mentioned at the eulogy that we now see George Bush in a more favorable light than we did back then. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, because time has shown that he was a gracious, all those years since he left office, never complaining, never whining about Clinton or why did he lose, or writing books about how he got euchred or whatever. They were sitting out there taking pot shots, just going on with a gracious life, working with Clinton, and really enjoying Bill Clinton. I don't know what his relationship was with Obama, not that much. But then when he had his 25th anniversary out of office, we had a thing down at the Bush School, and I remember Tom Harkin, who was a pretty rugged partisan Democrat in Iowa, came to be one of the participants to talk about how Bush had put together the Americans for Disability Act, which Tom had very much helped with, and how he had done the Clean Air Act with Bill Riley and a bunch of us and George Mitchell. All of us worked together for the benefit of the country. These guys are working for the benefit to who can screw the other guy in the other party. It's absolutely breaks your heart. And that's why a bunch of us old war senators got together and said, make it work. The Senate, if the Senate can't work, nothing's going to work.
Al, I've always said this, but I see you. You are a man of caring and decency, and I am honored to call you my friend. So thank you.
Jimmy, you're a good man yourself, and you've done very well, and I'm very proud of you. I watch you like a hawk because somebody has to. Your mother probably given up.
I'll tell you said that. Well, Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about George Bush.
All right, Ken. You bet.
Take care, my friend.
Bye-bye.
There you stood on the edge of your feather, expecting to fly. Well, I laughed, I wondered whether I could wait. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Political Junkie 2018 Remembrances Special. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content, including my annual column with a more thorough list of political figures who passed away this year. It's all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, or if you want to share any of your own special remembrances of the past year, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin, wishing you happy holidays, and we'll see you in 2019.